Hello, and welcome to this PERspectives Continuing Education Podcast, created by healthcare professionals for healthcare professionals. PER is a leader in healthcare education and offers free accredited medical education programs in a variety of accessible formats at gotoper.com. Daniela, we're happy to be able to talk to you. Tell us how you were diagnosed with beta thalassemia. And David, please share how you learned of your wife's diagnosis.
I was a baby. I was diagnosed with beta thalassemia major at 4 months old. And because I didn't remember exactly what happened, I was told the story from my parents. So my family and I, it was my mom, my dad, and my older brother. We went on a winter trip to Vermont. And I think we were going to be there for like a weekend or so. And it was during a snowstorm. So I was outside, from what my mom was saying. I was outside playing with my brother. I was young, so he was kind of holding me and we were kind of like playing in the snow. And usually when babies are out in the cold, like they'll get those rosy cheeks. But my family noticed that something was off because I was almost like yellow. I had like a yellow tint in the face. So we immediately, my brother brought me inside immediately. And my mom was like, what's going on? They were really nervous, took my temperature and everything like that. And I believe the next day they brought me back to Jersey and they brought me to my pediatrician at the time. And they ran a bunch of tests. And that's when they saw, I guess in the blood work or whatever they did, that I had beta thalassemia major. My parents were really nervous at first, but they did know of the condition because I do have a distant relative overseas that had it.
So when we first started dating, she was something she didn't probably tell me right away. It was still like a couple dates into it, getting to know each other a little more. She told me like, hey, something I want to let you know just from the beginning, kind of from the beginning, that I have this condition. And my initial thought was nothing of it because I didn't really know anything about it. But going based off the name of it, it's thalassemia. It's like, oh, it's anemia. A lot of people have it. It's normal. They live with it. It's, you know, you look perfectly fine. And there was like an initial thought of it's nothing. And still to this day, we think about it like it's kind of nothing. But I didn't realize how much it really engulfs her life. There was a lot to it. There was medications. There was the conferences she would go to. There's a lot. It was like a whole community I had no idea about. I was like, oh, wow, this is actually something bigger. I thought I was just going to be like, hey, I take medication, go to the doctor once a year. But there's more to it that I had no idea about that. I'm like, oh, okay, it is something that's part of your life, but you still live life. You know, she still goes out. She still does everything she wants to do. We still things we want to do. We traveled a lot. And she's done plenty of things. I'm just like, wow, you just never think you have somebody with this condition.
Dr. Kuo, what is your reaction to what Daniela described about her initial symptoms and diagnosis, and what are other initial symptoms commonly seen that prompt patients to seek medical care?
So what Daniela presented is actually not unusual. It's quite common for these patients. Most patients with thalassemia major tends to present themselves between age 4 months and 4 years. And that's usually because of the fact that the amount of fetal hemoglobin in their blood would wane around that time. And of course, that would come along with anemia. So you would have typical signs and symptoms of anemia. So fatigue, jaundice, scleroderis, splenomegaly, failure to thrive, lethargy, these are all very, very common. And I think that the way that Daniela's family sought medical care, again, is not unusual in how patients would present themselves.
Dr. Al-Samkari, what do you think are the barriers that can hinder making an accurate diagnosis?
I mean, a lot of hemolytic anemias present with sort of a similar outward clinical presentation, and there can be many, many different underlying causes that can cause that congenital hemolytic anemia or that chronic hemolytic anemia. So with thalassemia, in particular beta thalassemia, I think it's one of the more easy ones to diagnose. Most folks are familiar with a hemoglobin evaluation, hemoglobin electrophoresis or HPLC. And these that test as a screening test is widely available and is, you know, quite accurate in helping diagnose patients who have significant beta thalassemia. People are often a little bit confused or don't understand the use of that test in alpha thalassemia, right? It's not a useful test in patients that just have alpha globin deletions. So it's important that ultimately, when we suspect thalassemia, we can do the initial evaluation with an HPLC or hemoglobin electrophoresis. We can look for other potential common causes of anemia and ensure that we're ruling those out. But we do get genetic testing. It's important to get genetic testing to really understand what that person's underlying genotype is. And both alpha and beta sequencing, alpha and beta globin sequencing, because, you know, patients, just because you have a beta globin mutation or two doesn't mean you can't also have alpha globin mutations. And it's very common for those to run together.
Can you give us an overview of how and why we classify thalassemia as transfusion-dependent thalassemia, or TDP, and versus non-transfusion-dependent thalassemia, and into this more modern classification that moves away from thalassemia major, intermedia, and minor?
Patients who are transfusion-dependent, as the name suggests, means that they are dependent on transfusions. Without transfusions, they will succumb to the effects of anemia and possibly death. And the use of transfusion, of course, extends beyond simply rescuing the anemia. There's also other complications, such as the complications from ineffective erythropoiesis, as well as hemolysis, like things like splenomegaly, extramedullary hematopoiesis, leg ulcers, pulmonary hypertension. And these would be the failure to thrive. These would be the other reasons why we would put someone on the transfusion-dependent state. Patients with non-transfusion-dependent thalassemia tends to have a more hemolytic phenotype, meaning that you see a lot of complications from the hemolysis, but not necessarily ineffective erythropoiesis. And this is why patients' hemoglobin set point with non-transfusion-dependent thalassemia tends to be higher, as well as the fact that they don't necessarily need transfusions to survive. Now, having said that, it doesn't mean that these patients don't need transfusions, period, right? There's certainly lots of instances where we would start transfusing a patient who are NTDT to begin with, such as those complications we just talked about, like extramedullary hematopoiesis and leg ulcers and splenomegaly and so forth. So I think it's important to keep in mind that these classifications are not hard and fast, but that they're fluid and that patients can transition from one state to another. Now, as you talk about why we want to separate the two, is because of, I think, in part, the way we manage the complications and the way we execute new therapies, the way we find new therapies for them. For the transfusion-dependent thalassemia, obviously, because they're dependent on transfusion, the complications that they have is severe iron overload in the different organs. And so the treatment, of course, traditionally is chelation, but then more importantly now with the newer therapies, what we're looking for is to reduce the amount of transfusions that they require. Conversely, when we treat patients who are typically non-transfusion dependent, we are looking for new therapies that can suppress or ameliorate a lot of the complications out of both the hemolysis as well as the ineffective erythropoiesis from thalassemia.
Dr. Al-Samkari, Daniela and her husband shared some of the impacts of the disease on their lives, but can you paint us a picture of the spectrum of disease burden and the impact that you've seen in treating patients over many years?
Absolutely. So, you know, we really focused a lot on, you know, and Daniela in her discussion of how she presented, focused a lot on kind of the more immediate symptoms, the immediate symptoms of hemolytic anemia. And we talk about jaundice and we talk about fatigue and constitutional symptoms, but we have to remember that chronic anemia has complications and chronic hemolysis has complications. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, children with chronic anemia, you know, they can have reduced physical activity, they can have mind fog and cognitive challenges in school. The hemolytic piece can cause endocrine abnormalities, impaired growth, iron overload, which I'll talk about more in a moment. When we talk about the impacts of chronic anemia on adults, we're talking about similar things: chronic fatigue, inability to work a full day, inability to, you know, take care of, you know, one's family, in terms of all of the things day to day that you have to do, requires good energy, good exercise tolerance. That can often be very challenging. Ultimately, patients with thalassemia, the vast majority of patients with significant thalassemia will develop osteopenia and osteoporosis, thinning of the bones that really put them at risk for serious fractures, and they will develop that at a relatively young age. And so it's very important to monitor patients with DEXA scans and ensure adequate calcium and vitamin D and ensure that patients are getting treatment for bone mineral density disorder when it is indicated, even when they're quite young, young adults, for example. Patients will develop iron overload very frequently. Patients who are transfusion dependent will develop it essentially by definition and will need chelation to prevent death from iron overload complications. Patients that are non-transfusion dependent very frequently will still develop iron overload due to excessive absorption of iron in the gut, driven by erythroferrone, a hormone secreted by erythroblasts in the bone marrow that are working overtime to try to compensate for the very short lifespan of the cells and the ineffective erythropoiesis. And so patients with thalassemia, whether they're transfusion dependent or non-transfusion dependent, will require monitoring for iron overload and very frequently will require chelation therapy, which we'll talk about more in a later module. I think it's also important just to highlight that there is a significant psychosocial burden with this disease. Children are often made fun of in school or victims of bullying because of jaundice and yellow skin. Adults can sometimes have challenges finding romantic partners for similar reasons because, you know, they outwardly appear ill or sick. And you know, the impacts of chronic anemia can have real economic impact as well, right? Making a person unable to finish school or college or unable to work a full-time job.
Thank you for that insight about symptoms and disease burden. Now, moving on to management, describe for us the management goals for thalassemia.
For patients who are transfusion dependent like Danielle, the goals are, of course, to ameliorate the anemia, which is to improve the supply of oxygen to the different organs, but also to minimize the complications of ineffective erythropoiesis as well as hemolysis. And this is why patients with transfusion-dependent thalassemia are put on a hypertransfusion program in order to suppress the endogenous ability of the bone marrow to produce blood. Last but not least, the transfusion is also there to improve quality of life.
What are the available iron chelators and how safe and effective are they?
These days, we have three approved chelator agents. We have deferasirox, deferiprone, and deferoxamine. And, you know, Daniela was talking about when she was a teenager, she, you know, had to get these subcutaneous infusions of chelation. She had to get the infusion overnight and couldn't go to sleepovers. And so she was receiving deferoxamine, our old friend. Deferoxamine can't be given orally. It has to be given parenterally. Typically, that's given in the form of a subcutaneous infusion pump that the patient hooks themselves up to and receives overnight. You know, obviously, right, this is not a very convenient, you know, therapy in that it requires many hours of being hooked up to a subcutaneous infusion pump. So the oral iron chelators, many patients find much more convenient, and we use them much more frequently now in the modern time. Those agents are deferasirox, which is really 4+ for liver iron chelation and perhaps 2+ for cardiac iron chelation. And then deferiprone, which is kind of the opposite. It's really 4+ for cardiac iron chelation, perhaps 2 to 3+ for liver iron chelation. These agents require monitoring, and they are associated with side effects. The most common side effect from iron chelators is GI side effects, things like nausea and dyspepsia and constipation, diarrhea. These are the things that people typically will have. Typically will have GI side effects, and that's exactly what Daniela complained of from her chelator. Deferasirox comes in two formulations, one that's a pill and one that's a powder that you mix with liquid and drink, which some patients can find very unpleasant. These drugs require monitoring. Deferasirox in particular can cause renal abnormalities. The most commonly discussed other problem with deferiprone is that it can cause agranulocytosis. And so these patients require regular monitoring, especially shortly after they have initiated the drug, to ensure that there are no other end organ complications.
Dr. Kuo, tell us about the data supporting use of hydroxyurea in non-transfusion-dependent thalassemia.
Currently, there is no data for TDT, but for the NTDT, the data is mainly comes from single-arm trials and retrospective cohort studies, and there is no randomized control trials. Well, let's step back for a bit and say and ask ourselves, why do we want to use hydroxyurea? The rationale is very similar to when we use it for sickle cell disease. We want to use it to boost the amount of fetal hemoglobin in the red cells so that we know that fetal hemoglobin are working. And the idea here is that if there is enough fetal hemoglobin in the red cells, then we can reduce hemolysis, perhaps even to improve an effective erythropoiesis. So the data currently shows that the elevation in fetal hemoglobin from baseline is around 1 to even 90% in some retrospective cohort studies, but really the average is around 20%. Last but not least, is that when we use any therapy, we want to be able to boost the amount of hemoglobin, right, in our patients, because obviously we're targeting anemia, but also to reduce the complications from the ineffective erythropoiesis as well as hemolysis. And from that perspective, hydroxyurea really, again, from these studies, doesn't show that big of an increase. We are looking at between 0.5 to 2.5 grams per deciliter with an average around 1.5 grams per deciliter. More importantly is that there is very little to no data to demonstrate that the long-term use of hydroxyurea can ameliorate the ineffective erythropoiesis or the hemolysis from the NTDT. My clinical experience is more of a miss than a hit with the hydroxyurea. I did find that it's helpful for a very few patients, a very small minority, but for majority of patients, hydroxyurea that doesn't do the trick in terms of solving the problems of the disease.
What data support use of luspatercept?
Yeah, absolutely. So hydroxyurea, an older drug, luspatercept, a much newer drug. Just to remind everyone, luspatercept, a recombinant fusion protein with a modified extracellular domain of the human activin receptor type 2B fused to the Fc domain of human IgG1, all right, so a recombinant fusion protein. Luspatercept enhances erythroid maturation during late-stage erythropoiesis. The exact mechanisms by which it exerts its effects are still not fully understood in patients with beta thalassemia, but nevertheless, it is FDA approved for transfusion-dependent thalassemia, where it can reduce the transfusion requirements and the transfusion burden. In a randomized phase two study, including 145 adults with non-transfusion-dependent thalassemia, luspatercept was evaluated, and there was a 2-to-1 randomization, luspatercept or placebo, and the drug was given subcutaneously every 3 weeks for 48 weeks during a double-blind treatment period. The hemoglobin response was really quite promising, actually. So about 77% of patients met the primary endpoint in the luspatercept arm of a hemoglobin response versus zero patients in the placebo arm, not a surprise. And about half the patients in the luspatercept arm had a hemoglobin increase of around 1.5 grams per deciliter or more. So really a significant hemoglobin increase. You know, we have some pretty good data now that you know, you might think 1 gram or 2 grams of hemoglobin increase, that's not that big a deal. Well, it really is that big a deal in patients with thalassemia, because we know that with each drop of 1 gram of hemoglobin below a hemoglobin of 10, these patients really have a major, significantly increased risk of complications of their disease and comorbidities of their disease. So being able to raise the hemoglobin that amount is meaningful. You know, this was obviously a very favorable result regarding hemoglobin, but with evaluation of the patient-reported outcomes in the study, the measurement in tiredness and weakness, there was not a statistically significant improvement between the luspatercept and the placebo arm. There was some numerical improvement for one of the time periods for the luspatercept group, but again, was not significant. So this is an interesting case because luspatercept is approved for non-transfusion dependent thalassemia over in Europe, but it is not approved in the U.S. And so right now in the U.S., we're sticking to luspatercept for transfusion-dependent thalassemia patients.
How do you choose between therapies or potentially refer patients for clinical trials when developing your treatment plans for your patients?
We really should be customizing a treatment approach to each patient. Everybody is different. Different people have different values and preferences. These newer therapies like stem cell transplant and gene therapies, they are what I like to call high risk, high reward, right? I think there's also differences between pediatric and adult. We know that stem cell transplant should really be offered to children up to 14 years old. But beyond that, we know that it's not safe to perform allogeneic stem cell transplant for adults with thalassemia unless it is done in a clinical trial basis. We also need to consider not just the cost, but also interruptions to life. In my experience, when chatting with patients, a lot of them like the idea of having their thalassemia cured, but many of them are at a time when they are pursuing higher education, they're having the first job, or maybe they have just fallen in love with a partner and they want to start to be married and have a family and so forth. And often knowing that their life could have a period of time where they could be interrupted because they have to go through the conditioning regimen and then also the recovery afterwards can be a little off-putting. And they'll often say, well, you know what, I like the idea, but I want to try that later on. And last but not least is the morbidity, right? As patients age, their morbidity will accumulate, different morbidity will appear, and we need to take that into account.
Dr. Alsamkari, tell us about the approved gene therapy.
You know, this is the future is now, right? So, you know, several patients of my patients with transfusion-dependent thalassemia, you know, were eagerly awaiting the approval of gene therapies. And now we have gene therapy approved in the U.S. for a transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. So not for alpha thalassemia, not for non-transfusion-dependent thalassemia, but transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. And this is essentially, you remove the patient's hematopoietic stem cells. Undergo viral transduction of a normally functioning beta globin gene into that patient's hematopoietic stem cells, and then you infuse them back into the patient, essentially like an autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplant. But it requires a conditioning because you have to get rid of all of the abnormal thalassemic cells, the patient's existing hematopoietic stem cell population, and allow the corrected hematopoietic stem cells to grow back. So, you know, a very promising therapy. So you mentioned there are a couple of these phase three studies of patients with transfusion-dependent thalassemia looking at various genotypes, right? Patients who had non-beta zero, beta zero disease, patients who had beta zero disease. And the conclusion really of the studies was that the vast majority of those patients had really dramatic improvements in their hemoglobin, really dramatic decreases in their transfusion requirements. You know, it really is a functional cure for a lot of these patients. And you may say, okay, what's the flip side? Why don't we do this for everybody? Well, it comes down to that conditioning chemotherapy piece is really the major thing. And then cost is obviously another major issue. So this is not inexpensive therapy, number one, but it is, in theory, a one-time therapy, which is a good thing, but not inexpensive. And then the conditioning piece does give a lot of people pause, and I think appropriately so, right? So you have to give busulfan-based conditioning, which, you know, there's no two ways about it. That ultimately, can cause long-term risks in terms of long-term malignancy risks, in terms of fertility in patients. There can be significant risks associated with conditioning chemotherapy. So that's really the main downside. But for those patients who have bad disease, I mean, it really is something that can really rescue their life and normalize their life. But you gotta find the right patient for it. It's not for everyone who has transfusion-dependent thalassemia.
Can you give us an update on use of pyruvate kinase inhibitors for thalassemia?
First of all, let's just talk about pyruvate kinase and pyruvate kinase activator real briefly. So pyruvate kinase is the last enzyme in the Emden-Meyerhoff glycolytic pathway. It is critical for production of ATP from glycolysis, and in particular in red cells, right, who do not aerobically respire, do not use the oxygen that they are carrying. Otherwise, they wouldn't be very good at carrying oxygen to other cells in the body. And so they are dependent on that anaerobic respiration from anaerobic ATP production from glycolysis. And with patients who have PK deficiency, right, which is a sister disease to thalassemia, they have reduced ATP levels in the red cell and hemolysis, chronic hemolytic anemia. In patients with thalassemia, they have an increased energy requirement because of the imbalance in alpha and beta globin chains. And so we can increase the levels of ATP in patients who have thalassemia with pyruvate kinase activators. So mitapivat is a pyruvate kinase activator that's FDA approved right now for pyruvate kinase deficiency and investigational in thalassemia. Etavopivat is an investigational pyruvate kinase activator that's being evaluated in thalassemia, among other diseases, as mitapivat is. And so right now, where the status of these studies are, we have some early phase data, in particular, a phase two study of mitapivat in 20 patients with thalassemia, both alpha and beta thalassemia, because remember, while those two diseases have different underlying, you know, problems, revving up ATP levels in the red cell can potentially be helpful irrespective of where that alpha beta globin chain imbalance is, and really for other potential causes as well of hemolytic anemia. So a phase two study was published last year that showed that 80% of patients treated with mitapivat 100 milligrams twice daily did have an improvement in their hemoglobin of at least 1 gram. And again, when we talk about hemoglobin improvements, 1 gram is a relevant improvement, and more than that is great in these patients with thalassemia. And it worked for both patients who had beta and alpha thalassemia in that study. So promising for the alpha thalassemia patients who really don't have much of anything in terms of disease targeting therapies. In another study, etavopivat, which is a once daily pyruvate kinase activator, is being evaluated in patients with thalassemia with, again, early data suggesting that this drug is effective at raising hemoglobin in those patients.
What gene editing approaches are being investigated?
In terms of gene editing, the two approaches that are currently sort of in advanced development include the CRISPR-Cas9 approach, as well as the CRISPR-Cas12a approach. And the editing is slightly different. In the CRISPR-Cas9 approach, we're looking into editing the BCL11A, specifically the ESE, the ESE region. For the CRISPR-Cas12, the editing actually takes place in the promoter region of the gamma globin. The resultant effect of both is the same. One, of course, is the disruption of the BCL11A leading to increased expression of the fetal hemoglobin. The other one, by interrupting gamma globin, by interrupting the promoter of the gamma globin locus, we can increase the gamma globin production and therefore lead to an increase in fetal globin. I think most noteworthy is the fact that there is a presentation at ASH this year looking into the CLIMB-FAL-111 interim result with the use of exogamglogene autotemcel for transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia. And in there, the study, which is a 24-month ongoing phase 3 trial, it has met both the primary as well as key secondary endpoints. This includes of the 35 patients available, 91.4% or 32 of the patients achieved a transfusion independence. And of those who achieve transfusion independence is around 35 days after the infusion of the exogamglogene autotemcel.
Daniela, have you experienced side effects of therapy?
So I've had reactions to both my transfusions and my chelation therapy. So with the transfusions, I had a couple when I was young. I would get like a rash, or I think I recall another time I ended up getting a fever and I had chills, which was really strange. And then I didn't have another reaction until like, what, a few months ago?
Yeah.
A few months ago, which was so strange. And they were back-to-back reactions. So same thing. I ended up getting a rash. I started feeling really itchy. So they had to stop the treatment immediately. And they gave me like a steroid just to kind of calm me down. And then the second time that I went for my transfusion after that, I got another reaction, which was so strange. And that time it was like bumpy patches on my skin, and same thing. I was itchy. There were like red bumps. So they had to stop it. The reactions that I've had for my chelation in the past, the first chelation therapy that I was on after the injection did not sit well with my stomach. I had a lot of, gastrointestinal issues, having trouble going to the bathroom, having a lot of abdominal pain, lower back pain. So once I stopped that, I never really had that reaction again.
Dr. Alsamkari, what do you recommend for ongoing patient education and support?
I direct my patients to education and educational both opportunities and documentation from the two major thalassemia patient advocacy organizations, the Cooley's Anemia Foundation and the Thalassemia International Federation. And then actually beyond that, there are also country-specific thalassemia patient advocacy organizations that may exist in an individual's country that can be very, very helpful with more local opportunities. And these groups are great. They have webinars, they have brochures, they have, even to this day, I still will use a pamphlet developed by a patient advocacy group for the occasional patient that needs deferoxamine because it's just so good at explaining it for that patient, you know, in patient-friendly language. So, you know, I think that these are, you know, the main resources that I direct folks to.
Thanks for listening to this PER Perspectives podcast. If you like today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening.